Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast today is Mats Wedderkop, CEO of Dream Influence.
There's a learning for everybody that sometimes you have to dare to invest in the right places, even though it doesn't necessarily yield immediate return on investment. But that investment in product is what has helped us bring churn even further down and enabled us to raise prices over and over again.
This is Mats. He's been running SaaS companies for nearly a decade now, but started his career early when he was 17 years old. And by the age of 18, he was managing 120 sales reps. After his early success, he founded his own SaaS company, which he scaled from 0 to 70 employees and $7 million in ARR. In July 2022, he was appointed CEO of Dream Influence, owned by Blazar Capital, where he turned around the business and grown it from 360k ARR to 1 million ARR in less than 1 year. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Mats to my podcast. We explore what he changed to create a cohesive culture to succeed. He then elaborates on the counterintuitive actions that he took to battle the too high churn numbers. He shares his secret to building a healthy inbound funnel of talent. And last but not least, he explains how he has been able to 5x his pricing and introduce contractual commitments from customers as a means to further expand the fan base. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, what questions to ask to reduce churn in your company? Secondly, that often churn is not about your product, but the ability to achieve success with your product in the expected time period. Thirdly, why you should prioritize cash over MRR in your early stage SaaS journey. And lastly, why customers should pay for onboarding and how to get them to do so. Well, hi, Mats. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
My pleasure. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, it's the second time we speak. First time we spoke was at SaaS Talk, and that's where I extended the invitation to also be a guest on the podcast because I think you got a fantastic story to share, a lot of things that people can learn from. And let's take it from there. So before we start talking about your company, Dream Influence, what drives you? What gives you energy?
Building. I think that's kind of the cornerstone for any entrepreneur, right? But to be a bit more specific, I really like building culture, building teams, and make my team achieve success, and that we as a team can kind of win. I'm a big competitor by heart, so ending up as number one on the podium with an amazing team, kind of getting us there, is definitely one of the very big drivers. The industry doesn't really matter too much. Obviously SaaS, but now I'm in MarTech. Previously I was in tech for restaurants, and that doesn't really matter a lot. It's more about being surrounded by super talented people and making a change in a industry. It doesn't really matter which industry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's, because you didn't found Dream Influence.
No.
You came into it. I mean, you've been there for almost 3 years. I just checked on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
2 years and 11 months. Yeah, I think you were brought in as a chairman.
Yeah.
And then a good year ago, July 2022, you took over as CEO. So, I mean, you weren't part of the initial start of the whole thing.
No.
But, just for the audience to get a little bit of a perspective, like, what's the mission that Dream Influence is on? What's the problem that you're solving?
Yeah, so we want to help micro influencers earn a living from what they're doing. We kind of have this vision of having helped hundreds of thousands of micro influencers across Europe basically earn a living from what they're doing and from their passion. And the way we get to that is through the brands, obviously. So what we do and the problems we solve are right now more brand faced. So it's a two-sided platform. And for the brands, we basically enable brands to scale their micro-influencer marketing. So we help them with everything from A to C, finding the right micro-influencers, getting the data on them, managing the set of micro-influencers that they're working with, managing the campaigns that they're doing with them, tracking the content, securing them legal rights, so content rights basically for 24 months, and then tracking everything going on in between, and in the end, helping them pay the influencers. So that's basically what we do on the B2B side. But the vision is actually more help the influencers earn a living. And the way we get there is by enabling brands to do some kick-ass influencer marketing.
Actually, yeah. Yeah, sometimes, I mean, especially when you're on your own as a freelancer or like an influencer, it's hard to do that. And glad you bring these two groups together in a more structured way, and then also make it measurable about what the impact is, because I think that's what makes everything better.
Yeah, exactly.
And nobody is, I mean, you sometimes see stuff, of course, on social and so on. It's like, cool. Like, what is it? What's going on here? Has anybody asked for this? Just more spam.
Yes. So that's also one of the key elements in what we try to preach to the brands. It's to try to not make it like just discount codes and basically a modern TV shop, but try to make it authentic, work with the same influencers over and over again. And that's where we're a bit different. The traditional influencer marketing platforms is very much brands going in there, putting up a campaign brief. Influencers can apply to become part of a campaign. They choose, let's say, 100 micro-influencers across markets. They then run the campaign. 2 months later, they have another campaign, and it's 100 entirely different influencers running that campaign. And that just doesn't work with the consumer today. It needs to be more of an ambassadorship where the brand lives with the influencer on their platform recurringly. And you can only achieve that by basically understanding that it is a human-to-human relationship. And it's not just an algorithm like when you turn on a TikTok or a Meta ad. It's actually more about building a true relationship.
Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree. I'm glad you take it from that perspective. Now, if you hear this story, it's almost like the best of both worlds. You know, for influencers, this is the place to then finally start making a living. For brands, is to find those people that actually, where you can build those relationships and get, like you say, kick-ass marketing.
Yeah.
But when you stepped into the company, the company didn't show those results. You know, I mean, when you told me on stage that the SaaS talk was negative growth, 20% churn, problems.
Yeah,
so
lots of them. But I think I definitely still saw the potential, we are getting there now. But yeah, negative growth and lots of churn, and negative growth primarily due to that churn. And what I did to fix churn was kind of, I didn't attack it in the way many would on surface level, because the knee-jerk reaction would be, why are people churning? Then kind of dive into that data. But instead, I flipped it upside down and I asked the question, why are the clients that are staying, to figure out what are we actually good at, and then do more of that. So what we learned was that the clients that had the most success was those clients that were actually working with the same influencers over and over again, and would commit to doing that for plus 6 months. They would stay. So if a client were in the business for 6 months or more, the lifetime was exponentially longer than for those that left early and didn't give it that half a year.
Yeah.
And that led to me basically fixing it really, really quickly by just introducing a minimum commitment of 6 months. So we would not sign clients that would not commit to working with our tool and our influencers for at least 6 months, because we could see that was what it took to get success. And if you're not willing to make that commitment, well, then you're a bad client for us and we're not a good match.
Let me make a small interruption here. Mats just made a critical remark about the secret that helped turn the company around in a variety of ways. Focus on amplifying why the right customers stay. It does a couple of things. It lowers churn to begin with. Secondly, it helps further define your ICP so you can start to attract more of them. It will then help programmatically turn more customers into fans, who then spread the vibe for you. And lastly, it increases profit and cash flow, critical for early stage SaaS businesses. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They focus on the essence, acknowledge they cannot please everyone, and then aim to turn every customer into a fan. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So it's actually kind of narrowing in the focus in the end, but the contract was the lever to creating that focus in the sales organization.
What happened?
Yeah, so basically what happened is that we halved churn overnight, because now they actually were forced to give it a try for 6 months. Obviously, there are still clients that then give up one month in or 2 months in because they're not seeing results yet and they are impatient. And then they just say, okay, that's a sunk cost. That still happens. So it's not like there's no churn, but it halved the churn basically with just introducing a contract. Prior to that, Mikkel, the founder, had just been writing emails with, this is the price, please write okay, and then I'll create your account and invoice you. So that's basically, at least in Denmark, that's actually as contractual as a formal contract that's signed. It's enough to get an okay on email, but it's just really hard to hold up in court practically. So we introduced a real contract and that helped a lot. And I also think what it did was that you no longer had those kind of clients that didn't really think it through, that were maybe too spontaneous or were too scammy and just scheming us as a provider. Yeah. Those were naturally sorted out, and that obviously also reduced churn. So that's kind of one of the first things I did during Dream to fix those issues. Another thing, which I think has been way more impactful long-term, is that I think 2 weeks before I officially started as CEO, I went to Saster in Barcelona, and I brought Mikkel, the founder of Dream, to kind of have a week together in Barcelona before I was starting and just talk everything through and then couple it with inspiration from a SaaS conference. And when the conference was over, we flew in Mikkel's co-founders, Louis and Rasmus, and then we rented an Airbnb. And we basically spent 2 or 3 days mapping out core values and identifying what are the core values of the founding team. Not of the business, but of the founding team, because the way they had hired was basically, you're a nice person, we are nice persons, we like each other, let's hire you. And that rarely goes very well, at least not long term. So we mapped out those core values of the founders to figure out what's the DNA of the business. What are you three guys like? And truth be told, they are very different. But the reason that they were able to stick together for multiple years, although they are very, very different in personalities, because they have these anchoring values. They have some similarities, something they share. And we map that out to three core values of the business. And then we've been hiring and firing religiously based on those core values ever since. And the first thing I did when I then started was kind of pull them aside and ask, do you realize that we have a few employees that are actually a bad fit for these core values? Not that they are bad employees. They're not bad people. They're not bad at their job. They're just not cultural fits. And yeah, kind of already knew and was like, so what's going to happen now is that we're going to fire them. It was a very small company at that time. So firing three people was basically firing a third of the company.
It's amazing. Right?
That was another thing I did. And that's very bold.
Good way to start as a CEO.
Yeah, exactly. But it worked out, and we hired replacements. We hired new people, and we made sure that they were very good cultural fits for the culture that we identified and mapped out in Barcelona.
Yeah,
and we hired and fired based on this ever since. And I think that's really kind of the secret sauce to us being able to grow in the way we've done. So we went from, what's that in growth? It's like 160% growth or something like that year over year. So from negative growth to 160% growth. And that's with very few people, because we're not funded in a VC way. We got a bit of debt, and that's basically it. And that means we've now surpassed $1 million ARR.
Yeah.
And we've done that with 16 people. So it's very, very efficient growth. Basically, until recently, roughly half of the company, a bit more, has been in product, and the other part has been commercial. So we even had a skew towards building for the future rather than just going out and selling what we had. And I think that's the first thing I did to fix those issues initially. And I was in a very luxurious position in the sense that normally a bootstrap company doesn't have the luxury to just invest heavily in products. I knew we've taken on a bit of debt, roughly $500,000. And that's not getting you very far if you're hiring product people. But I knew that our owners, so Dream Influence was acquired in April last year by something called Blazer Capital, which is basically a holding co and an incubator. And I knew that the owners had my back. So I went to them with a plan of actually investing heavily in product in order to fix these wider problems with negative growth and churn and kind of getting the business to a good place. And they bought into that plan. So if we for some reason failed on our growth targets, so that we would go into the negative on cash flow, I knew they had my back. And that's why we dared to invest. But I think there's a learning for everybody that sometimes you have to dare to invest in the right places, even though it doesn't necessarily yield immediate return on investment, because product doesn't. But that investment in product is what has helped us bring churn even further down and enabled us to raise prices over and over again.
Yeah, that's an interesting story in itself, yeah. Because I mean, that was the third point that we talked about at Saaster. Yeah. Let me recap a little bit, because it's like there's a lot of going on here.
Yeah.
So the started with negative growth, primarily because of the high churn percentage, 20%. Yeah. And then you do a couple of things that are super contradictory to what normal people would do, what other people would do.
Yeah.
First of all, you don't look for like what's wrong with the customers that churn, but you look what's right with the customers that stay.
Yeah.
That's typically you're really acknowledging for your company and for everybody else in the business that you cannot please everybody and get the focus there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's fascinating what she did and how simple it was to get the churn from 20 to 10, so half it.
Yeah.
And then now we have to kind of move on. First thing you do is cut the company by a third.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then of course start building forward. And I think that's a great, I mean, first of all, it gives a sign about, okay, we're in this for real.
Mm-hmm.
This is who we're focusing on, nothing else. This is the use case, and this is how they're going to be successful. We're going to do that with the right people that can actually stand for this.
Yeah.
And then you said something about you had some depth, but at the end, I think you're a prototype of, and that's also why you were on the bootstrap stage. You have the prototype mindset of a bootstrapper. That's about, you know, the best possible funding for the business at the end is customer revenue. And if you focus on getting the right type of customers in, the customers that are committed, these are also likely customers that are prepared to pay a premium for it, you know, because it's not about it's too expensive. It's actually quite cheap for the value I get from it.
Exactly.
So what's the story around pricing?
Yeah, so with the investment in product, we were obviously getting to a point where we also became increasingly confident in raising the price. I remember having a very heated discussion, and we do that a lot. We have passionate ideological discussions on our first quarterly business review after I started as a CEO. That first summer, me and Mikkel had a very, very passionate discussion about pricing, because I felt we were priced too low. And he was afraid of changing the pricing structure and changing the pricing overall. And I can totally relate to that, because I was the exact same way in my first startup. But I managed to convince him that we could do it incrementally. So we could start by just raising it roughly 80 euros per month in each tier. And then if not, then we agreed if we didn't get pushback from at least a third of the clients that we were talking to, then we were not priced high enough. That we could agree to. And that's just a very like simple rule of thumb. It's not very scientific in any way, but it's just sometimes it doesn't have to be that scientific, and sometimes it doesn't have to be fancy. It's just like if a firm doesn't say, hey, I think that's too much, can I get a discount? Then we're not priced high enough. And we kept raising the price over and over again.
Let me keep there. Like you said, 80% on each tier. But what did the tier start on? So was that a 5% raise or was it a 50% raise?
Not 80%, 80 euros per tier. So the tiers at that point were like, I think the cheapest one was 150 euros. And then the second tier was 200 euros. And the third tier was something like 320 euros. That was kind of the three tiers. And we raised all of them just with a flat fee of 80.
Okay. So for the smaller tier it was about 50%, and for the other ones around 30%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we kept raising prices with just around 80 to 100 to 150 euros every time. And the point where we are today, where the most expensive package is now 1,000 euros per month. And I expect
all the way from 300 up.
Yeah, 300 to 1,000.
Perfect.
Yeah, and I expect that we are going to raise prices on all of the tiers again in January, because we're still not there. We still don't get a third that push back on price. So we're probably going to make it so that the middle tier will be close to 1,000 euros from January, and then we'll bump up the highest tier to probably 1,500 or something like that, and then make the smallest tier 670 or something in that range.
Yeah, that's another fascinating aspect again. You know, a lot of SaaS founders start this way that, you know, the contract is 1 month.
Yeah.
just to make it as small as possible. The price is as low as possible, just to lure people in, and then hopefully they'll stay.
Yeah.
And it just drags the churn up. And
it does. And also, oftentimes, it's not even worth the effort because you get people in on a 1 month contract. Are they really committed to making it a success? They probably have 10 or 20 other investments that they've done that quarter in the business. And if those 10 or 20 other investments are exponentially bigger than what they did with you, why should they focus on making return on the investment with you and not on the others that are way bigger and where they have more on the line? So sometimes you're actually kind of doing yourself a disfavor by kind of going that low on pricing and that low on commitment. Sometimes it's way better and a way bigger favor to yourself and your business to say we just need one client instead of six clients. And if that one client pays for half a year or a full year, then that's equals the same amount. And early days, I think a lot of, especially first-time SaaS founders, what they do wrong when they are kind of pre-funding, if they decide to go the funding route, is that they focus too much on the MRR instead of focusing on cash. Cash is king. When you don't have investors, you need cash. So with cash, you can build something truly great. So if you just go the month-for-month payment route without funding, then every time you close 12 clients, you generated what equals to one client that pays for a year.
Yeah.
So why not just close 10 clients for the first quarter that pays for a year instead of trying to close 120 in the first quarter that pays for 1 month?
Yeah.
It's I know the MRR compounds and everything, but you need that cash very early on.
Yeah, wise advice.
And then when you get off the ground, then you can switch the focus to actually just growing your MRR and ARR. And I think that's also some of the learnings that I kind of brought into the business, that we need to focus on cash and we need to focus on upfront payments. And then it has this ripple effect of customers also being more committed, because you might even commit to a 12-month contract paying, let's say, 500 euros a month. Yeah. But it's only 500 euros a month that goes out of your bank account. And it's probably such a little amount that you don't even notice. Right. But if you pay 6,000 euros in one go and maybe an onboarding fee on top, then you actually feel it. That's probably something where there's a second level of security and compliance for getting that amount of money out of the bank. And there's probably a legal process internally, so you have to convince internal stakeholders. Obviously, it makes the sales process longer, but it also makes the commitment so much bigger. So I think that that's really a nuance to your pricing that a lot of founders are missing out on.
Yeah, I mean, you just summarized a couple of very, very big lessons that a lot of people don't see or don't want to see just because of that fear. The other thing it also does that I constantly see is, you know, the moment you get on that flywheel of customers that actually have the highest potential to become fans, they, first of all, they are prepared to pay a premium for what you do.
Yeah.
No discussion around that. They buy more often and bring more people like them. Whereby if you get all these customers that are sort of okay on the platform and like they will never become a fan, and they are a drag to implement. They keep your R&D people crazy. I mean, they just harass them with all feature requests that nobody else wants and so on. And it just blurs the whole vision.
It does. And I think what's really funny about that point, John, is also that often if you go in and you analyze your company's clients and you look at the support load, what you'll find is that often it's the clients that pays the least and has the quote-unquote most favorable pricing that drags the most on the support. So I get where it comes from. 2020 and 2021 was all about like hyper growth. Just put things on the top. Don't care about what's up there. You just had to grow at all cost. And money was basically free in those days. So you could apply that approach where you just got everything with a pulse in. But now where money isn't free anymore and we kind of have to at least strive to be default alive as companies, then you kind of have to flip that narrative and you have to think a bit more in depth about why you price as you do.
Yeah, even if it was still 2021, 2022 and the money was free and the funding could come in at zero interest and these kind of things, negative growth and 20% churn still don't add up.
No, that doesn't add up. That doesn't add up. I was talking about those that didn't employ contracts and long upfront payments, but they were just kind of getting customers in with success without churn. I get why it was done that way in 21, but I think it's not looking at the unit economics deeply enough, because what really drives our growth at Dream also is we have, so our CAC recovery is roughly 3.5 months. And when clients then pay 6 months up front, we basically secure ourselves 2.5 months of MRR that we can use to acquire a new client. So for every time we acquire two clients, we have more than enough money to acquire one more.
Yeah, okay.
So it's really adding up when it comes to kind of getting your money back. If we kind of calculate our recovery with the cash flow instead of the MRR, we have negative recovery. And that's what's enabling us to grow.
Yeah. Smart. So what has been the hardest nut to crack in this process? I mean, what is the biggest learning that's after 1.5 year right now?
Yeah. So I think it's actually most on people. We obviously has this very strong culture, but when you come in as an outsider or semi-outsider, I was the chairman, but so I work with the management team. But when you kind of come in as CEO and you take over somebody's baby, that's one, a very big responsibility. And two, I also had to kind of come in and set my team. There was a reason the company was running as it was, and it was my job to change it. That was why I was brought in. And Mikkel, as an example, went from being CEO to being CCO. And later, actually, I stripped him of that title too and just made him founder for a period. He's CCO again now, but for a year, he's just been founder. He was still at the table. He was still at my management sessions, but alleviating him of that pressure and that responsibility that follows the CCO role made him more able to grow, basically, because now I could focus on just making him grow as an individual rather than keeping him accountable for delivering a CCO. And it was the same thing on our R&D. So Rasmus, the co-founder, was co-founding CTO, and I got the option to get in my former CTO from my own startup. We kind of grew that together in the management team from roughly, I think we were at 1 million when he joined back then. And then when we left, both of us, we were at 7 million. So we kind of did the journey together before. And, mm-hmm. and by sheer chance, I could get him in. So kind of getting him in as CTO and then removing Rasmus as CTO.
That's tough.
That's two founders that were on the management team that's no longer, at least officially, on the management team. Obviously, their input was very valued still. Uh-huh. Miguel and Rasmus had two kind of different dynamics because Miguel was actually at the table still. I kept him at the senior management table. He was at all of the weekly tacticals, monthly strategics, quarterly business reviews. He was part of my reporting to our owners and so on. Whereas Rasmus went more down to becoming Scrum Master and product owner. And that's a very big leap from being at the table to now maybe feeling like I don't have any influence anymore. And that's obviously not the case, especially not with the culture we have. But it's still, there's a lot of ego in people, and being able to help them putting that ego aside was key to succeeding with that. But that was an uphill battle for half a year.
How did you settle this in a way that everybody is happy with?
Yeah, so I think it's a lot about transparency, making them feel in the loop and really involving them still, making them feel valuable, making them feel that they still have something to say, and then accepting that it is not something that's just going to be perfect from day one. It is a gradual process that will take time, and having the patience to make it work was definitely key. And I think what made it increasingly hard was actually not only Mikkel and Rasmus obviously having to settle in. It was also that it obviously also looked a bit dramatic from the owner's perspective, from Blazer Capital's perspective, that I come in as CEO, I remove two of the founders from their C-level roles, which they acquired a couple of months back, and I fire a few people and I bring in a lot of new people to the company. Obviously, that looked very drastic. But it all turned out very well. And I actually had a campfire with one of the partners of Blazer Capital recently where we were discussing this, because he got the question how they as owners were reacting to me kind of coming in and rocking the boat that much. And he was very honest and said, well, we were shitting our pants that the founders would be demotivated and leave. But again, back to our culture made it possible, because that was based on them, it was based on the founders, and that didn't change. Yeah. So it still felt like their company. The feel of the company fundamentally didn't change. It was just which people were in which seats that changed. Yeah. And then obviously the easiest way to make, and that happened, the easiest way to make these things go smooth is by delivering results. And the numbers speaks for themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
We more than doubled in 12 months. And then you can't really argue with the decision of doing it that way. So that's another thing that obviously helped.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That works for you rather than against you. Yeah. Still, it can feel hard. But I mean, it's also, of course, it requires a little bit of resilience from people. And that at the end, it's about the dream we have, the mission we have. That needs to be accomplished rather than...
Yeah.
In a startup, everybody wears different hats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're only 18 people now, so we still wear different hats. We all have different hats. That's how it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And the hierarchy is not a hierarchy yet. It's super, still super flat. And if you only do it just to have that title.
But I actually think, that what I did is it can actually spark a lot of fruit for thought for a lot of founders and co-founders out there, because it's look at all of the like companies that end up IPOing, like the success stories, the big success stories, and then count how many of them actually have their founders in the management team at that time. I'm not saying we are at that stage now, but I actually think the underlying message here is you need to, one, put your ego aside, and you need to, two, have a very honest dialogue going continuously about, are we still the right people in the right seat? And it's okay to not have to be CEO or CTO or whatever C-level title all the way. Because maybe you can hire somebody that's better suited for it, and you can do what you actually love. And that might be building the product or selling to the clients or doing customer success or diving into a financials or whatever it might be. But sometimes it's actually the right thing for the company to get somebody from the outside in and take over on what you might not be excelling at the stage which you are at.
Yeah, that's true. I've seen that many, many times. And the company I used to work for as well, you know, the company went through different stages, including an IPO, already at the stage where the company was possibly not even beyond 100 million, like slightly beyond, before that even. And yeah, I mean, there's, well, to get from A to B and from B to C and et cetera, you often need a completely different set of people to
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And being able to put your ego aside and admitting that I might be the perfect person from A to B, but not from B to C, that requires obviously a lot of self-insight, but it also is a very important discussion to have within the founding team, because it can eventually kill the company if you are too proud to make that decision.
Yeah. Good point. Two more questions, because I'm also looking at the clock here.
Yeah.
I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and that's what I'm always interested to hear from people that are out in the field, eventually writing my second book on the topic. What do you steer for to create a software company that people start talking about and keep talking about?
So I think we do two things, basically. So one thing is that we are very customer-centric. That always helps. And I think it's basically becoming a commodity that you have to be customer-centric, but you can really excel at it. The second thing is actually a framework that we deploy in our organization where it's called Tour of Duty. It's out of the book The Alliance by Reid Hoffman and Chris Yeh. Mm-hmm. So basically, what we do with a Tour of Duty is we sit down with every single employee. We ask them, even before they are hired, we ask them, what are your personal goals within the next 3 to 5 years? And let's say we have a marketing employee and his goal is to become CMO in 5 years of a software as a service company. And today he's just a marketing associate. Then what his manager will do is he will say, okay, what goals, company specific goals, can I create for you and set for you that will help you either obtain results or skills that will help you get one step closer to that dream. Then the Tour of Duty is time boxed. So normally it's 12 to 18 months. And there's obviously check-ins during those 12 to 18 months, and the manager helps everything he or she can to help the individual to succeed. And then when there's 2 to 3 months left, they have a longer evaluation meeting where they evaluate, okay, will we hit the targets? That's close enough that they'll know if they'll hit the targets. And they have a very honest dialogue about, is it now that you move on to that dream role? Maybe the marketing manager now feels comfortable that he can land a CMO role somewhere else, or maybe the position has become open at us or something like that. But there's this very honest dialogue. And even if it's not with us, because let's say somebody wants to become CEO, well, that's me. So you probably can't. but then if we can help you become CEO somewhere else, what happens is that when he then have employees or coworkers or colleagues that needs to move on from that place, and if they are a good fit for us, he will send them our way because he knows what's good. He values the company. He talks about the company fondly because we were the company that helped him achieve his dreams. Yeah. And what that essentially creates is a huge funnel of inbound talent with time. It takes years, but with years, you get this amazing inbound talent funnel where your heroes that you helped to succeed, that was great successes in your company, are now referring people that they believe is a good fit. So we have the best reference that you can get at all. And we also get forecastable FTE count because we have that dialogue upfront. So they don't come one day and say, hey, I landed another job. We know it upfront. We finished the Tour of Duty together. And if we're not doing another tour, we know we're starting to look for a replacement.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thanks for sharing that.
That's a motion that creates a company that people talk about.
Yeah. I hadn't heard of the framework, but definitely a good one to look at it. Still, I got one question. You talked about, okay, it's like it's maybe the default that everybody's talking about customer-centric and you need to excel at it. But the question at the end is like, what are you doing specific to excel at it?
Yeah. So we actually, we do a couple of things. One thing is that we obviously run a very tight support so that you always get answers on the day that you write us. But that's very baseline. One of the things that we kind of do, and that's actually a bit back to the thing of implementing contracts and commitment from the clients, is that we force every client to pay for an onboarding. There's no, I don't want onboarding, or I just want to get started myself. We actually force them into a program that is tailored for them 6 months long, where we follow them meticulously for 6 months. We set goals with them and we make sure to take them on that journey through those 6 months to make them a success. And they get a designated person that takes them through that 6 months journey that's mapped out from day one. But we force them to do it. They are forced to pay for it. And when they pay for it, they also want value for it. So then they actually motivated to do it.
Very good. Yeah, that's it sets everybody up to become a fan. And the rest is then history. I mean, that will start. It will also become your flywheel. And talking about, you know, something that's forecastable. That is the most important part for that part of the business. They got two of the flywheels going.
Yeah.
Nice. Last question then. From everything that you learned, being founder, CEO of two companies at the moment, what will be a do and what will be a don't that you'd like to share, based on what you know right now?
Oh, that's a lot. So let me try to break it a bit down from a founder's perspective. So if you are to found a company, there's something very basic, but I'll make sure to, one, have the right amount of co-founders. In my first company, we were 5 co-founders. We ended up succeeding, but that was probably more luck than knowledge, because that's too many. You'll just get that as a red flag every time you talk to a VC or some other funding partner. When it comes to finding your founding team, make sure you complement each other on skills. If you're building a tech startup, make sure you have a technical co-founder. That's key. And then when you've found your team, create something that seems super unsexy and unnecessary at the time because you're best friends and you're excited, but make sure to create a shareholder agreement. This, you cannot get divorced without it. And even with it, it's super hard to get divorced. It's a journey that you'll be doing for the next 10 years, most likely. So make sure to write the rules before you start. And remember, when you write them, it can seem very hard what has to be in there, but it's only a document that you'll bring forward if you actually have big disagreement. So it's all right that it's hard. It has to be. Then kind of moving forward from that, back to the kind of, it's 10 years. Make sure what you choose is something that you truly want to do and that you're truly motivated by, because you're in it for 10 years. So it cannot be the motivation, the underlying motivation of doing it cannot just be, okay, I want to be financially independent by my 30s or 40s or whatever. It has to be more than money. It has to be something else that drives you. And there has to be another reason for you to embark on that journey, because it's a long ass journey and it's with people that you cannot get rid of again. So make sure that you choose the right thing to work on with the right people. I think that's, and you can even apply that logic to choosing a new job. If you are a manager or a C-level, make sure to work with the right people on the right thing, because there's nothing worse than being miserable in your job.
Exactly. Well, these are very nice words to end an avalanche of value that you gave. Thanks for that, for sharing sort of the secrets almost behind your company. Where can people go to find out more about Dream Influence or to say hi to you?
LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn. Sure, we can link me in the show notes. Obviously dreaminfluence.com or dreaminfluence on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way to catch us.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure on my end.
See you.
And this ends my conversation with Matt. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Matt Weddekop, CEO of Dream Influence. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at tom.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.